liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss the fight against privatization in Pennsylvania with Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale. We'll also learn about sequestration's impact on border security with National Border Patrol Council Vice President Sean Moran. But first, we've been joined by AFGE National President J. David Cox. President Cox, welcome back.
Thank you, Jason. Glad to be back.
President Cox, sequestration has taken effect, and many federal employees are under the threat of mandatory furloughs. What's the latest with this situation?
Well, Jason, each day it gets a little worse. As sequestration began on March 1st, every day we move closer to federal employees being furloughed, federal agencies having less resources to provide services for the American public. So each day I've been using the analogy of the frog in cold water. Each day the water is being heated up, and each day the situation becomes more critical.
President Cox, how have AFGE members responded to this?
AFGE members, number one, they've been very concerned about the services that they provide for the American public. I've heard repeatedly about, well, who will help these people with their Social Security claims? Who is going to provide this care in the military hospital? We make parts for the airplanes that supply our men and women in the military in Afghanistan. Who's going to be doing those type things? I hear a constant concern from federal employees about these issues, but then there's also the concern about their own financial well-being. We're talking about in Department of Defense, each employee being furloughed 22 days between the last of April and September 30th. That is a significant amount of time. That's one day a week. That's a 20% cut in pay for employees. That's a real hit in anyone's budget, an astronomical hit.
And President Cox, you bring up a great point about the impact of those furloughs in DOD, 22 days between the end of April and the end of September. And these, of course, are for middle-class Americans, not the richest of the rich, correct?
Oh, very much so. Most of these employees, their average take-home is about $500, for a week. So, I mean, let's be real. Now we're talking about $400 to make a house payment or to pay rent, to make a car payment, to buy gasoline that's between $4 and $5 a gallon nowadays, to provide school lunch money for their children, which is a minimal of $4 to $5 a day, and that's a small amount. If the child don't eat much, they can try to get a school lunch for that amount of money. That's a significant decrease in income. It will affect local communities because these employees will not have the funds to spend. So it will be a domino effect. It's projected that it will affect 1.5 million jobs in this country when we need jobs, not a less jobs. We need more jobs.
President Cox, you make an interesting point again. The choices that federal employees are going to have to make in regards to their finances, and this is between, as you said, between making the rent payment or the mortgage payment and being able to fill your car up with gas or give your child lunch money.
Clearly, that's what they're going to be facing. I mean, when you're talking about a 20% pay cut, that's a significant pay cut for any individuals. And I'm talking about people, about an average take-home pay around $500 a week. Not a great deal of money.
President Cox, last week AFGE led a series of more than 100 rallies nationwide to protest these cuts, and you participated in one in St. Louis, Missouri. Talk about the feel there on the ground.
It was great, Jason. The day was cold, to say the least, but we had over 200 AFGE activists who were out there on the ground that rallied for over an hour outside of one of the senator's offices there in St. Louis. Some of our folks met with him, explained the impact that would be happening upon the local economy, the services to the American public. We picked up a lot of press coverage. I think we are taking our case to the American people about the hardship they are going to suffer as federal employees are furloughed.
And what do you think the response will be from the American people after seeing and hearing rallies like these?
Clearly, the response we had last week that the American people were with us, they are supporting us. They were talking about the fact that yes, less hours at Social Security offices, and that people can't go and to try to process Social Security claims. Less screeners at airports, that means longer lines, less air traffic controllers in the air, that means less planes able to take off. The military the Department of Defense supports, all of those DOD workers, such an impact, and many of our military bases and other institutions are located in communities where they're the major employer.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with J. David Cox, AFGE's national president. President Cox, with some of these things that seem to be on the employees' favor in terms of having some clear statistics to point to the impact that these cuts will have to their livelihood, with maybe a little bit of more understanding from the American people on what it means for the services that they would be provided, what is AFGE doing to fight back against this?
We are fighting back in several different ways. We are assisting our councils and locals with bargaining agreements that would help lessen the impact of the furloughs. Most of these agreements require agencies to bring in the Unemployment Security Commission folks to at least advise people of unemployment benefits that would be available to them. Also, we have certainly been working with the agencies about service contracts. The federal government spends billions, tens of billions. It's a lot of money, Jason, on service contracts that work could be done by the current federal employees throughout the government. And we have been bringing to agencies' attentions and working with OMB to get guidance given to where that if you're going to cut back on these service contracts, don't cut back on federal employees. And obviously, our rallies last week, we got a great deal of attention nationwide, and we will continue these type of activities. And we're certainly putting a lot of pressure on Capitol Hill, even though they are now on a two-week break. But we will continue to hold that pressure to the members of Congress while they're back in their districts and in their states to share with them the impact it's going to have and the devastating effect it's going to have upon the American economy.
Being part of an organization, leading an organization that's fighting back against these efforts, is this almost a reminder for you of how important an organization like AFGE is, how important the labor movement is at times like these when someone needs to stand up and fight back?
Clearly, Jason. I mean, but for AFGE, who else is going to fight these battles? No one else is fighting them. I mean, we are the largest federal employee union. We are the one out there every day that's battling on the behalf of federal and D.C. Government workers nationwide. But for us, no one would be out there leading that charge. So the need for organized labor and the need for AFGE has never been greater. And that's why people need to join our union, be a part of our union, and become an activist in our union.
Earlier, you mentioned the impact that these furloughs would have on DOD workers, looking at about 22 days of mandatory furloughs from the end of April through the end of September. Let's talk about another agency that's going to get hit pretty hard as well, and that's Border Patrol. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, Jason. At the current time, there's conversations going on. Hopefully, Customs and Border Patrol may be able to shift some monies around and may not furlough employees quite as many days, but there has continues to be a decision about what's called as their administratively uncontrollable overtime that Border Patrol agents operate with. I mean, obviously, when you're on the border, you're chasing drug smugglers and all these type folks, you can't just stop because it's quitting time. These people continue to work long hours. Most of them work 10-hour days, but they're only paid 8 hours a day. There's a part of their pay formula that compensates them for this extra time, which currently, because of sequestration, they're going to tell these folks, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We're just not going to pay you this extra pay, which equates to about 25% of their basic pay. So that's that is a very, very hard hit. And also it will decrease the border protection of this country.
And that's something that certainly is a concern when you're talking about the safety and security of the United States borders, correct?
Clearly. I mean, the safety of our borders and the safety of the Border Patrol agents is extremely important. These are dangerous jobs. These officers are murdered. They are shot. They're exposed to a very, very tough environment. These are very, very dangerous, very, very tough jobs. And again, to have your pay cut by 25%, have furloughs over top of your head, I believe it would be extremely hard to be focusing on trying to make the border secure while all this is going on. But yet they're the most dedicated employees that I have ever interacted with.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll continue with AFGE National President J. David Cox.
Attention AFGE members. When cash is not an option, discover purchasing power, a better way to buy brand name computers, electronics, furniture, and more through convenient payroll allotment. AFGE members enjoy the lowest everyday pricing of all federal employees. And now until April 15th, AFGE members can save 15% on orders of $1,500 or more, or save 10% on everything. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower. Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with J. David Cox, AFGE National President. President Cox, before the break, you were detailing the safety concerns of border security agents, border patrol agents, and you made a great point that securing the nation's borders is not an eight-hour-a-day job. It's something that happens 24/7. 365 days a year. And some of our other agencies throughout the federal government have similar sorts of job responsibilities, one of which is the Bureau of Prisons. Now, they're in a tumultuous time right now, recently coming off the killing of a correctional officer who was killed in the line of duty. What can you tell us about the state of BOP these days?
The Bureau of Prisons continues to be severely understaffed, Jason. We have requested a meeting with the Attorney General, waiting a response from him and setting a meeting date to discuss our concerns. You're right, the recent murder of one of our correctional officers in Pennsylvania is a crime that should not have happened, and it happened simply because there's understaffing in the Bureau of Prisons. They are operating at far under the number of staff that they should have. They've had hiring freezes. There's been less funding for the Bureau of Prisons, but yet there continues to be more inmates in the environment. And let's be real about the inmates that's in federal penitentiaries. These are not people that just ran red lights or did some little bitty crime. These are people that are convicted felons. Many of them are serving life sentences for murder, for very vicious crimes of, of rape and crimes against small children. Many of them are drug dealers and certainly into very, very strong drug cartels. These are seriously dangerous individuals. And to put one correctional officer into a housing unit of 150 inmates alone is unconscionable, just totally unconscionable.
And I think that you did a good job there of almost setting the scene of the circumstances around the death of Eric Williams, the correctional officer who was killed recently at the United States Penitentiary in Canaan, which is in northeastern Pennsylvania. Correctional officers are unarmed. Many times they're working alone in a housing unit, supervising up to 150 inmates or more at a time. Do you think that the agency or the attorney general recognized these facts when shifting some money around recently to be able to avoid furloughs in BOP and give these officers a chance inside the facility?
Clearly, I think that there was some serious thought put into it. The memorandum that I saw from the attorney general was very clear. I thought it was very heartfelt with the words that he put into it. But also, even without the furloughs, and we are very thankful that we've avoided the furloughs in the Bureau of Prisons, the staffing is still at a critical stage. Just critical. We will continue to have assaults and deaths of these correctional officers, and it's not just the inmate that murders these folks. It is a system that's also guilty because we're placing people in harm's way by having inadequate staffing.
What do you think can be done going forward to alleviate this problem? And you're right, the stoppage of the furloughs was just a basic fix, essentially. But there's a larger problem there of correctional officers being severely outmanned, outnumbered, and with no means to really protect themselves inside the federal prison.
Look, we are going to have to fund the federal government, and the federal government does very many good things for people in this country. And Jason, I had just noticed the front page of the Washington Post today, and there was an article right on the front page. It says, for Dow 30, tax burden isn't what it used to be. And this article talks about that the top corporations who make up the top 30 corporations of the Dow industries, that their tax burdens or tax fairness, let me rephrase my words, in the 60s and 70s, that most of the companies routinely paid federal income taxes of between 25% and 50% on their worldwide profits. They now pay an average of 15% of their profits in taxes, while their stocks have soared, all those type things. Now, there's a school of thought, if we just don't tax companies, then they will create all these jobs and make the world a better place. Well, obviously, that's been happening now, and where's the jobs, and where's this better place? Part of our problems that we have shortage of staff in the Bureau of Prisons, while we're not paying Border Patrol officers, is that there is an income problem for the federal government, and that it's many individuals and corporations are not paying their fair share. You and I both pay higher taxes than 15%.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with J. David Cox, AFGE's national president. President Cox, in the VA, an agency that you know well, serving your entire working career in the government as a registered nurse, you know the staffing challenges there, and which has resulted in a claims backlog. Can you talk to me a little bit about that entire situation?
Sure. Again, Jason, we are dealing with a very large claims backlog in the VA. Part of it is the fact that Congress has continued to not fund the VA in the appropriate mannerism. There is a need for more claims examiners in the VA. And if you hired those claims examiners today, they would be fully functional 2 years from now. It's about a two-year on-the-job training process to get these people functioning. And so, again, we are back to properly funding the government, having enough employees to process the claims, and to also have a work environment and performance standards that's conducive to employees doing their work. Currently, the VA has performance standards that they believe if they just tell everybody, just work harder, work faster, and make all the claims go away, that it will happen that way. It just doesn't occur. People can only do so much work. These claims are very, very complicated because many of our returning veterans nowadays have multiple injuries and multiple things that's going on with them.
Can you talk about the strain that it puts on the employee who's trying to reduce the number of claims in the backlog, and then the stress that it puts on the recipient who's waiting for a decision?
Clearly. I mean, it's the process in VBA is that floggings will continue until morale improves, and it's work harder, work faster, produce more claims, get it done faster. That affects the quality, and the bottom line, you want a quality product. In the end, you want that veteran's claim adjudicated properly so that they can receive whatever benefits that they are due for their service-connected disability, and it's certainly a hardship on that veteran that is out there waiting. It's one, again, the government needs to fund. The government needs to hire more people to process those claims and to offer valuable training to those folks to get them up and running where they can do that job.
And many of the things that we've talked about here today have centered around a lack of funding, a lack of staffing. But sometimes an agency can make a decision in terms of a policy that also puts either the workers or the public in danger. And we're looking at a situation in TSA where you've been pretty vocal on the policy change allowing small knives on planes in saying that this also could be dangerous for the workers and for the traveling public. Talk to me about that.
Oh, clearly, Jason. AFGE is clearly on record opposed to knives on planes. We were notified less than 1 hour before TSA came out with this new policy. We have joined with the Association of Flight Attendants and all of the other unions, the airline unions, and many other folks who are totally opposed to this policy. With TSA, we believe that it will place our officers and members into greater conflicts with the American public. I mean, it's like one of the officers now will have to be explaining to a passenger, well, your knife is too big, it doesn't meet the standard, all these type things. And I know it's like, oh, TSA needs to be looking for the big explosives versus taking small knives away from people. But still yet, here you are with a passenger. You're telling the passenger you can or you can't take something on the plane, and now you introduce a knife into the process. The flight attendants have been very openly opposed to this. They are not interested in having knives on planes. We believe that it is wrong. We believe this policy was a bad decision by TSA.
President Cox, did you or anyone from AFGE have a chance to sit down with Administrator Pistol or anyone from TSA management and discuss this idea before the policy decision was made?
No, not at all, Jason. We were given less than 1 hour notice, and it was like, we're calling you up to telling you this is what we are going to do. Thank you very much. There was like, we'd like to discuss this idea and have your input. Less than 1 hour's notice. Those are bad decisions. You have to have input of stakeholders. That's the employees. That's certainly every airline has come out opposed to this policy. All the flight attendants, the airline pilots, all of these employees have come out against this. It is just a bad, bad policy.
Do you think that there will be an opportunity to impress upon the agency your feelings about this and perhaps try to evoke some sort of change or compromise on the issue?
Clearly. We have voiced our concerns to that, and there has been legislation introduced, and we believe that it is going to clearly be a legislative fix that the Congress of the United States can pass a law that says that you can't carry a knife on a plane. Congress has passed laws that have said you can't smoke cigarettes on planes because it's harmful to people. It is certainly harmful to people to carry knives on planes.
AFGE National President J. David Cox. President Cox, always fun to have you on the program. Thanks for coming by and updating us on the happenings of AFGE.
Thank you very much, Jason, for having me today.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll be joined by Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale, who will discuss the fight against privatization in Pennsylvania.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to AFGE.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
FederalNewsRadio.com, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Rick Bloomingdale, the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be on.
The Pennsylvania State House of Representatives last week voted in favor of HB 790, which would eliminate or privatize 5,000 jobs in the state's wine and spirits system. Give me a little background on what's happening here.
Okay. It's your listeners, I know you're a nationwide program, so your listeners may not be as familiar with the Pennsylvania system as we are, certainly here. But we have a totally state-run wine and spirits shop system where the state does the volume purchasing and they have to handle the distribution, as well as the retail stores are all run by good, hardworking state employees. And because they are in a union, they have decent middle-class wages, benefits, and a pension. And over the years, there have been a number of folks who have used all kinds of excuses to try to get the state out of the system. But one of the real benefits of having, besides these good jobs that they provide, we've been able to keep the incidences of underage drinking, because there's no profit incentive. When you walk into a state retail wine and spirits shop, there's no incentive for that person to sell an underage drinker any kind of alcohol, because their job depends on it. And unlike in a corner liquor store where somebody might walk in, see their buddy behind the counter, buy some booze, and then go out and get drunk, you don't have that here because, the profit motive doesn't exist for the retail clerks. So it's been a real benefit in terms of, look, we want folks to enjoy responsibly the wine and spirits, if that's their what they like to do. But we also want to make sure that, this epidemic of binge drinking and those kind of things, that we have some kind of control on it. Because alcohol, in the end, is a drug. It's a regulated drug in our society in terms of what age you can drink at. But Pennsylvania, we've always taken it a step further to make sure that we try to keep it out of the hands of our youngsters. And the state system has done that very well. And of course, there are the big box stores and all kinds of folks who want to privatize it because they see the money, and they don't care about the consumers, and they always hide behind consumer choice. But in fact, because of our volume purchasing, that we're able to do. And Pennsylvania is the largest single purchaser of wine and spirits in the world because of, you know, just the size. We're able to provide a huge selection that a corner liquor store might not be able to, and do it at prices that are very competitive. As a matter of fact, on a good bottle of wine, you can't see the difference between the border states and Pennsylvania. So the forces of the right, of course, say that they want to get those, you know, get the state out of the wine and liquor business. And of course, you know, I always find it interesting as because conservatives tend to not be pro gambling or pro alcohol, but in this case, they've put the interest of the privateers above the interest of the citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
So for those who want to remove the state from the process, when you talk to them about your concerns with underage drinking, what's the response that you get?
Well, they, some of them have bogus studies that say that's not really an issue. And, you know, and I don't know. I mean, it happens in D.C. as much as it happens here anymore. You know, Senator Moynihan had a famous saying where he said, you know, people are entitled to their own opinion. Everybody's entitled to opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. That seems to have lost any kind of serious ground here because they just reel out these false studies that are totally bogus, but they think they're entitled to their own facts. They just deny the truth of the matter, which is it's pretty bizarre. I mean, we had all kind of, you know, church groups, Lutherans, Methodists, all opposing this mad Mothers Against Drunk Driving, folks who have a real concern about the cost of alcohol addiction, and they just totally, chiefs of police opposed it. They just totally ignored the facts and said that's not true. And they pretty much thought that they're going to do this because I guess the money was big from the big box. Really. Of course, you know, Walmart wants to put, you know, wine and spirits in every store they have. And, you know, there's a local chain here of convenience stores that, you know, wants to have wine and spirits. They want to make it universally available. And while we have about 670 stores in Pennsylvania, they've increased the number of potential licenses to almost 2,000. So the concerns that the folks had expressed that, you know, we didn't want a liquor store on every corner, that seems to be out the window. And there were a number of conservatives who were concerned about that. But in the end, they pretty much voted with it to send it to the Senate. And, you know, they did all kinds of goofy things to get votes. Everybody who wanted an amendment, they put in it, with the exception of protecting workers, right? Those amendments never got considered. But the amendments to protect the small business guy who might be put out of business by the big box retailers. Our beer distribution system, it's fairly complicated. It's run by small business folks. There's nobody has a monopoly. You're only allowed to own one beer distributorship, and that's where the majority of beer is sold, and that's private in private hands. But now the big box stores are going to be able to sell beer as well. And so you had the beer distributors who were worried, and the source they put in amendments that said the state will buy their business, which so much for the free market, right? So it was a messed up bill. It's a bad piece of legislation. Even our newspapers, who tend to be for privatization because of the potential ad revenue that would be generated, have said that this is a really bad bill and that consumers lose. So much for their consumer choice argument as well. It's a bad bill. We fought hard against it. It's in the state Senate now. We'll continue to fight hard there. The governor has made this one of his issues as he continues to try to privatize everything from our lottery to our wine. You know, anything that makes money, that brings revenue into the state, they want to get rid of course, because if they don't have revenue, they can say, oh, we can't do this in government, we can't do that. It's an attempt to pretty much destroy state government.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Rick Bloomingdale, the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Now, Rick, while this bill passed in the State House of Representatives, it was close. It was about 105 to 90, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of the vote count. Now, as it heads to the State Senate, which you mentioned is coming up next, what are your expectations there?
Well, we hope that the Senate is going to look at some of the contradictory amendments that are in there. The Senate leader, the majority leader, who's a Republican, has said that they are more interested in modernization rather than privatization. They're being a little bit more responsible and grown up over there because they understand, you know, the state liquor store system, one thing I forgot to mention, brings in about $500 million of revenue into the general fund. So it provides money for a lot of services for the citizens of Pennsylvania. That money would all be lost, of course, in privatization. And so the state Senate understands, you know, they're trying to do the right thing in terms of being responsible. I mean, you were right about the vote. It was close. We had five Republicans who stood with us in addition to all the Democrats. So over in the Senate, they're looking at how do we replace the revenue. They've not been, you know, the right wing is, oh, the taxes it'll generate because we're selling more booze. We'll easily make up for that, but of course the numbers just don't add up. And as we know, on the right wing, their math skills seem to be somewhat challenged.
You mentioned earlier that the bill from the House, you don't agree with it, and you said there was pretty much everything in there except worker protections. And my next question for you, Rick, is what does all of this mean for the workers in Pennsylvania who man these 670 stores around the state?
Which there's about close to 5,000 workers in the state system, and it'd be like closing down a factory. Now, you know, they did say, look, there'll be some training money. There'll be they'll be able to transfer into other jobs, but with the loss of revenue, you know, and they'll be given a chance to work in the new liquor stores. And of course, those are going to pay minimum wage, right? Rite Aid's not going to be hiring more people. They're just going to, or Walmart or any of those, they'll just clear off shelf space and put in booze and alcohol. They're not going to hire any more people to take care of that. I mean, I've been in other states where they have private systems. You don't have a wine expert wandering around, you know, the drugstores, helping people select their wine or answer questions. I mean, we have some fairly skilled people in these stores, and you know, the Walmarts of the world aren't going to hire a wine expert. They're just going to, you know, get rid of some milk and cookies and put in wine and beer. So the workers, you know, they did say, oh, there's some retraining money. And, you know, but if you're in many of these people, it's a career. You know, if you're near the end of your career, what are you really going to train for? And again, it's once more the workers get the short end of the stick. And the privateers run off with all the money.
You alluded to this earlier, President Bloomingdale, that this is part of a more broad effort in Pennsylvania to privatize some services. You mentioned the Pennsylvania State Lottery System. Talk about your concerns with this larger effort and what the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO is doing to combat them.
Well, of course, we're mobilizing as well as we can. All of our public sector unions are very engaged. You know, and this attempt, I mean, the lottery, which brought in lots of money, and the only way this British company could actually make more money is to expand gambling, which is in, you know, if the state wanted to expand gambling, they could make that same money too, right? The administrative costs are low. It's a great thing, provides lots of services for the people of Pennsylvania. Of course, the whole charter school business is just another privatization scheme. Bust the school teachers unions, bust the state employee unions. You know, the right wing has figured out they've gotten the private sector down to about 6.5-7% of the workforce is unionized. In the public sector, it's in the 30s. They've figured out that the public sector and private sector union, we're the last bastion out there protecting the middle class. We're the last barrier before they can totally go to back to the robber baron days of the very wealthy and the very poor. So they've attacked the private sector relentlessly, the private sector unions. Now they're going after the public sector unions. And charter schools, you know, now we've seen test after test after test or scores where they don't do any better than the public schools, except that now somebody who owns a charter school isn't making a couple of $100,000, which a superintendent of schools does and deserves, by the way. It's fairly complex systems that these folks run. But now they're running off with millions of taxpayer dollars with no accountability. They're not teaching our kids any better than our public school teachers. And, you know, they're getting away with it. And, again, it's transferring public wealth into the pockets of private individuals and companies. And that's what the right wing has decided. They're going to take all the tax dollars and they're going to make people wealthy with the tax dollars rather than putting that money into the pockets of into services for the citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Rick Bloomingdale, the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Rick, great to talk to you again. Thanks for taking the time.
Jason, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about sequestration's impact on border security with AFGE National Border Patrol Council Vice President Sean Moran.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program's administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorney's fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Sean Moran, the Vice President of AFGE's National Border Patrol Council. Sean, welcome to the program.
Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Sean, sequestration has taken effect, and it appears that Border Patrol agents are being hit particularly hard with a pay cut of about 40%. Talk to me about this situation.
Yeah, it's a pretty difficult situation for agents to absorb, one, because of the financial impact, and then two, because of the impact it's going to have on our operations. Between the furlough days and what's known as administratively uncontrollable overtime, and leave it to the government to call something overtime when it's actually straight pay, but our agents, those two things combined, we're looking at 40% loss of pay.
What does that mean for not only the Border Patrol agents in their financial lives, but then the trickle-down effect to border security?
Well, the AUO is the 9th and 10th hour that Border Patrol agents work. They've done it since we can prove that they've done it back to the 60s, and we've heard anecdotally from retired agents that they've done it well past that. And what it is it allows the oncoming shift to overlap with the offgoing shift and maintain a presence out on the border. And it also allows us, if we're tracking a group of illegal aliens or we're in a pursuit, to be able to continue that and to maintain a secure border. Sometimes it's more than just 2 hours. An agent may work an additional 8 hours under AUO, and they're being paid straight time. It's the more important thing is that the border security is maintained, and under this, the problem of sequestration, that is just going to be slashed. Agents are going to be forced to work 8-hour shifts, and that's going to leave gaps in coverage, and border security will be definitely impacted.
And something that our national president, J. David Cox, mentioned earlier in the program, Sean, is that border security is not an 8-hour-a-day job. This is something that requires 24 hours a day, 365 days a year of watchful eyes, correct?
That's true. The criminals are always on standby waiting to go. They're waiting to expose a weakness or any type of lapse in coverage. They have all day to wait and watch and react to how we're doing our operations. And they're very good at it. They have ways of getting people or drugs across the border. They're willing to sacrifice a group of 50 illegal aliens that they know will be caught in order to get one or two people across the border. So it definitely is a huge item, and border security will definitely be impacted by this. And it's a really scary thought because the Secretary, Janet Napolitano, has said the border is safer than it has ever been. And while that might be factually true, the border is by no means secure.
You mentioned that criminals are able to expose weaknesses. Are you seeing any evidence of that taking place now?
Yes, we are. We're seeing increased drug trafficking and trafficking of illegal aliens from Imperial Beach, California, which is the model station for the Border Patrol in terms of deterrence and Operation Gatekeeper, out into Tucson sector. The entire sector is still very busy. And the Rio Grande Valley sector over the past year has definitely increased. And in the past few weeks, since the word of sequestration and staffing cuts has started to get out, agents have reported that illegal aliens that are being caught are saying that they were under the assumption that they were going to be let out of jail or that there weren't enough Border Patrol agents to patrol the border, and that's why they came across. So when the staffing cuts actually do take place, starting on April 7th, we could be in for a wild ride.
So then those who may be trying to bring drugs or other illegal substances into the United States, they're aware of these situations taking place.
Like I said, these criminal organizations are highly complex. They are very smart. They have, you know, been working in these areas, in some cases, their entire lives. You know, some of these people are recruited from very low-income, poverty-level areas of Mexico, and they've been involved in smuggling or being a foot guide since the time that they could walk, and they know very well our capabilities, and when they see a drop in manpower or a drop in response times, they are poised to take action and take advantage of that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Sean Moran, Vice President of AFGE's National Border Patrol Council. Sean, with the passage of the continuing resolution in Congress recently, we saw some agencies, I'm thinking particularly BOP, was able to move some money around to avert any furloughs throughout the system. Did your agency see any kind of relief with the passage of the continuing resolution?
Well, there's been talk that we may not see furlough days, but we're looking at that as kind of a shell game to distract the public. They're going to say, you know, CBP and Border Patrol will say that no Border Patrol agents are being furloughed, but then they won't mention that there will be staffing cuts due to the loss of AUO. This is just political cover for the agency. They have wanted to get rid of AUO for at least 6 years. There's been talk for far longer than that. But this gave them a convenient excuse because under the CR, they were given enough money to cover salary and expenses, but they have said from the beginning that the only place they can legally make these cuts are under salary. Meanwhile, they have funds, one of them called Best Fit. And to be honest, I'm not really sure what this fund does. I've been told it's job retraining for, you know, intra-agency jobs. But I know that this fund has almost $500 million in there, and it's not being used. And Congress chastised the agency for the way it made its cuts, for its spending and accounting practices. But yet when the CR is passed and they're given enough money to maintain staffing, they go ahead and they cut it anyway.
So your big concern here is with the AUO. What are your colleagues saying about this situation?
This is a deal breaker for a lot of people. I've had agents tell me that they're going to lose their house because they won't be able to pay their mortgage, especially in Southern California. I've had agents who have said that their wife has already threatened to throw them out of the house because they're not going to be bringing in. They'll be bringing in a little over half of what they did previously. And it's just going to have a devastating impact on family lives, on financial security. It's going to have a huge impact on retirement. Many agents have told me that they have applications in elsewhere, or they have job offers from other agencies, some even state and local. And we've advised them that if they have that and that is a better life for them, that they should go ahead and do that. Some agents have said they're going to go back to their previous law enforcement jobs because even though they didn't make as much money, they're going to make more money now because of the cuts to AUO and possible furlough days.
Sean, give me a sense for what it's like to be a Border Patrol agent.
Being a Border Patrol agent is a very difficult job. You go in at the beginning of your shift. You have a muster with the other people that you're going to be working with that day. And you get prepared for what you're about to face. And sometimes it could be hours and hours of boredom waiting for something to happen. But our strategy is deterrence-based. You have to be there. And when you hear a sensor go off or another agent spots a group, or a helicopter spots a group of illegal aliens or smugglers, or you don't even know what it is sometimes. You have to go check it out, and it can be very dangerous. The terrain is very rough in some areas. The weather can play a factor. You know, you still have to get out there, whether it's a downpour or it's 110 degrees or it's 10 degrees below zero. You have to get out there and find out what crossed the border, and you never know what you're going to be up against. And agents have come to accept the danger. We've lost 119 agents in the line of duty, my brothers and sisters in green that have given their lives for this country because they believed in the mission. And, you know, this kind of spits on their grave, as it were, because we're giving up on the mission. We're cutting the staffing and basically throwing the border open. And it's just something that does not sit well with agents. And like I said, they've learned to accept the danger of the job, but they don't expect to be knifed in the back by the agency.
So what then can you do as a representative of AFGE's National Border Patrol Council to push back against some of these efforts against you and your colleagues?
Well, we are looking at our different, bargaining possibilities and possibilities for litigation. I won't get into too much detail about that, but we are urging the public and urging our members day after day to get in touch with their congressional officials, because Congress is not happy with the agency, and neither should the public. So we urge them, if you want border security and you want agents to be out there at the full staffing levels, call your congressional officials and, you know, just urge them repeatedly to make sure that the agency does the right thing.
Sean, what kind of support are you getting from the public, from your neighbors and your communities, the people who know that you all go out there and secure the nation's border regardless of weather conditions, regardless of the danger involved, regardless of the terrain that you have to navigate on a day-to-day basis? What kind of support are they lending to you all?
You know, Jason, since Homeland Security was formed, we've had some great support from the public. Our profile has definitely gone up. Most people didn't know that we even had a Border Patrol prior to 9/11 and prior to the creation of Homeland Security. So people have realized the danger that does exist on the borders, and they want it stopped. They want to be protected. So we've had a great groundswell over the past decade of people supporting our agents. We see it all the time on our Facebook page and our Twitter account. People are able to, you know, contact us directly. And both of those are at BP Union. It's facebook.com/BP Union, and on Twitter, the handle is BP Union. And, you know, all the time we get messages of support, not only from our members, but from the general public, you know, saying thank you to all the agents that are out there working the line and protecting me and my family.
Sean, as we close out here today, what are your final thoughts on this situation?
This is a situation that needs to be stopped. For far too long, we've just let border security be a house of cards that was built on a foundation of lies, and it's time to stop playing games when it comes to border security. We've been a political football for both sides. Nobody really wants to take border security seriously. We want to, you know, make it look like we're being serious without actually doing anything concrete. So it's time that the public is aware of the games that are being played, and it's time to tell Congress to stop it, and especially the spineless leaders that lead CBP and the Border Patrol. They need to be thrown out, and we need to get somebody in there that's willing to do the job correctly.
Sean Moran, Vice President of AFGE's National Border Patrol Council. Sean, we appreciate your time here today and also the work that you do in keeping this country safe and secure.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE National President J. David Cox, Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale, and AFGE National Border Patrol Council Vice President Sean Moran. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife.